I'm Emily Thede, author of This Vicious Grace, coming in summer 2022 from Wednesday Books.
And I'm Anna, a teacher and a writer in the Queery Trenches.
And you're listening to Basic Pitches, where we...
Two basic pitches.
Break down the basics of writing and being a writer. Hi, everyone. This is Emily. I'm here with Katrin Burry today. Anna had a conflict pop up, so it's just going to be the two of us. And we are excited to talk together because we actually are... agent siblings, we're fellow 22 debuts, and I don't think we have ever actually spoken aside from text. So how are you, Katrin?
I'm fine. So nice to talk to you finally, not in a big meeting on Zoom or on email.
Those are kind of intense. Yeah, I was just thinking this morning about our first interaction was when Chelsea made the offer and reached out and asked me if I would talk to you. I think I probably sent you like, what, a 10-page email or something talking about how much I love her.
It's okay. That prepared me for Chelsea's 14-page edit letters.
Yes, exactly.
Which are fantastic and famous.
They are fantastic. Yes, I am expecting some notes after the holidays. She kindly had said, you know, I can get them to you sooner. And I was like, no, that's fine. Just you hold on. Go enjoy your holiday. I'm not quite ready for that quite yet. But yeah, we're having you on today because we want to talk about your debut, which is coming out pretty soon. Can you tell us a little bit about it, what it's called, what it's about, and when it's coming out?
Yes. So it is a middle grade mystery called Drew LeClaire Gets a Clue. And there might be a second book. I don't know. I'm keeping things very close to the vest. Trying to maintain a secret there.
Gotcha.
So basically, the pitch that I did on DV Pit, which is how I got Chelsea, my agent, I pitched as like a more openly queer Harriet the Spy for tween murderinos.
I love it.
And because I think, you know, at least for me growing up, when I read Harriet the Spy, I got the feeling, you know, she was not just cishet, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And but, you know, back then, I think you weren't able to say things as openly. And
so true.
I really wanted to write a book for kids like I was, kind of a little bit creepy, like to make notes on people.
A born writer.
Yeah. So the pitch is 12-year-old true crime obsessed Drew LeClaire has always dreamed of becoming a profiler. So when a cyber bully targets Drew and her friends, she fights back with science by profiling all of the bullies at her school.
I love it. I actually relate to that in a special way because I was someone who was diagnosed as an adult with ADHD. And I look back now on some of my favorite characters in books and movies. And it's like the world just comes up and kind of grabs my face and goes, honey, how did you not figure this out sooner? You know, thinking of like Maria and the Sound of Music. I watch that with my kids now. And I'm like, how? I watch that movie, I think, every day for like my entire preschool year. And now I look at it, I'm like, it is so glaringly obvious to me why I related to this character. So I love that you saw yourself in this character and then you were able to take it and expand it and make it more, you know, clear on the page for readers so that they don't have to necessarily read between the lines. It's really cool.
Yeah, exactly. Because I think when you're growing up and things aren't said explicitly, I think there's an underlying feeling that there has to be like shame surrounding mm-hmm. it. And that's one of the reasons, even after I got married to a dude and had a child, that I felt the need to come out because I told my husband, if I don't say this, then what is my daughter going to think? She's going to think, why does she have to hide this?
Yeah. Right? I think that's brilliant. I think that's wonderful. I'm so glad that this generation of kids is getting just such a wider expanse of role models to grow up with. I don't know how old your kids are, but I think they're a little bit younger than mine. And already, I think there's just been such a sea change in publishing over the past, even like the past 10 years, honestly. I mean, not even talking 10, 20, 30, but just the past 10 years alone in terms of what we think kids can handle. And I think for a very long time, there was this attitude of like, one, if something doesn't directly relate to you, then you don't need to read about it, which is a horrible attitude to have for children. And you know that even if it shouldn't be broached until you're an adult, which is absurd, because as long as there are diverse children, they're going to have diverse experiences and they should see that on the page. So I can only imagine how quickly Chelsea snapped you up. And I kind of know some of your journey with Chelsea and going on set. But why don't you tell our listeners about it since they didn't all get the privilege of the behind the scenes stuff?
Yeah, so it was actually kind of a long journey. So buckle up. I'm gonna tell you the whole saga. I started writing when I was really young. I started writing when I was 6 years old. I started writing a series of mysteries. I was really obsessed with mysteries. I just loved how they played out. I would watch Poirot with my dad and all sorts of like English mysteries. So a lot of this character, Drew, and her relationship with her dad watching true crime together in mysteries is based on me and my dad. So I just kind of always wanted to be a writer. I wrote my first novel when I was 12, and I started calling publishers up on the phone just saying, like, have you received my manuscript?
I love that.
Spiral-bound manuscript. And I think I got one person saying, like, oh, we're taking it to the committee or taking it to acquisitions or something. And I said, oh, well, please let me know how that turns out. It's like this 13-year-old.
Do you think they actually were? Or were they just being nice? What do you think?
I have no idea. I was a 12-year-old or 13-year-old, so probably they were just being nice, but I don't know. Yeah. Nothing ever came of it. I got a very kind rejection from Troll Publishing. I don't know if you remember Troll. No. I did not get my first novel published at 12 years old.
Probably for the best, honestly.
Probably, yeah. Halls of Fear may see the light of day someday, but it'll probably be rewritten many times.
Yeah.
And so I kind of, you know, kept writing books throughout the years, you know, kind of made an effort, sent out a couple queries, but not that many because I just really did not like all the rejection. And then I decided to really give it a go a couple years ago, and it was a slog. I've racked up over 250 rejections from agents.
There.
And I've written several books. There were some books that I'm just like, oh, I wrote this book, queried it, rewrote the entire thing, and then it still didn't go anywhere.
Yeah.
Which is just heartbreaking. You feel like you've lost a member of the family, you know?
Yeah. Have you thought about bringing some of those back out? Like, now that you have an agent, are you eyeing some of them, or you think most of them belong in the drawer for now?
I'm like, they're good, but I still don't think the market is interested. Yeah, like, I think there was a reason that they didn't get picked up. So I'll just wait kind of patiently, like a cheetah.
Build your fan base.
Yeah. Anyhow, I like to tell people that you always hit a point where you're like, can I do this really? And I did about a month before I wrote this book, Drew LeClaire Gets a Clue. And I was sending a book out on sub. It was going nowhere. I had just shelved another manuscript. And I was crying to my husband for like 48 hours straight, saying maybe I should give up, but maybe I just want to write this one more story. And I did. And amazingly enough, it got 5 offers. So
I call them the screw it books. And I found so many authors have that exact story, that you hit that point where you're like, I can't do this anymore. Like, maybe I'll write one more because I just want to write it and I don't even care if anyone likes it. And if this one doesn't work, I'm done. And it's just, I think there's sort of a, you kind of take the guardrails off and like lean into that thing you want to write because you're already on the brink of giving up. And a lot of times those books just have this like extra, I don't know, something to them. I mean, you can just feel it. Like, there are some books that I've read and I am like, I can just tell that this author was like, I'm going all in. Because at this point, like, I've played by the rules and it hasn't worked for me. So whatever, I'm just going to write the thing I want to write. And I think that just comes through. So, you know,
yeah.
It's no fun. It's not fun to be in that moment, but I think it can spur us to new greatness in a way.
Yeah, it can produce some great books. I think I was listening to one of you and Anna's podcasts with, is it Lindell?
Yeah, Lindell.
Mm-hmm. Lindell. And I love this concept, and I've always felt that way, of writing the book that you want to read.
Yep.
Right.
Absolutely.
And I had never written a middle grade, but I thought to myself, like, I wish middle grade would have this. I wish they would have this kid. I haven't read this since Harry the Spy. I want to see this kid again. And so I wrote it, you know.
It's like, I mean, I think it's the same drive that gets people to write fan fiction. It's, you know, it's a similar feeling of like, there's this thing, I want something more, and you're waiting for someone to give it to you. And then there's this moment where you realize, like, wait, no, I can give it to me. I don't have to wait for someone else to do it. And I think that's wonderful. I know my kids are going to be super excited to read your book when it comes out. So we're very excited. So then, you signed with Chelsea, and then the whirlwind began.
Signed with Chelsea, yes. And then many, many rounds of revisions followed.
She does not play around.
She does not. I mean, it was wonderful working with an agent who used to be a fantastic editor.
Yeah.
because I felt that the product we were going out with was so tight.
Agreed.
That
Parenthood.
That they, you know, that they basically that people couldn't turn it down.
Yeah.
Because maybe less work would have to go in on it. So, and that was also the feedback we got when we did end up getting an offer is, wow, this is like really tight as is. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, when same I did here. Get I think. I think too, you know, these days editors are so strapped for time and energy that if you hand them, I mean, it's like handing them a book with a bow on top, being like, you are not going to have to spend nearly as much work to get this ready for shelves because it basically already has gone through an editor. And it's funny to me because I keep wondering if it was because, you know, you both of us signed with Chelsea really pretty early on in her agenting career. And there was a part of me at the time that thought, I don't know if she can keep this up. Like maybe at some point she'll back down and kind of do a little more of a somewhat standard agent thing of like doing some polishing, but then sending it out. But I don't think she can.
Yeah.
Capable of backing up and being like, let's see. Like she wants it to be perfect and she pushes you to do it, but it pays off.
It so pays off. Like it's amazing. I think that, I mean, I really had no question about signing with her when she offered because she had been top on my list. I had been afraid to query her prior because she was so high up there. And then when she requested on DV Pit, I'm like, oh my God, here's my chance. And then when she offered, she just had the perfect vision for the book that I knew was going to see it through. Like we had to make a lot of changes and I was worried. I'm like, is this going to look like my book? After and then when I did all the revisions, I was surprised that it looked even more like my book.
Yeah, that's like wildest thing to me about revision is one, I had this weird moment once where I realized like, oh wow, like every book could be 1,000 different versions of itself. Like there's a strange moment where you're like, there's so many like branches, like the road's going in so many directions, I don't know where it's going to end up. But it's true that like, I think if you're working with someone, whether it's an agent or an editor who has the same core vision for your book, it's amazing how much you can rip apart and move around and still end up with something that's the same thing, but better. I have the same, you know, Chelsea, I always joke with Anna that Chelsea was like, oh, this is great. Can we get this sooner? This is great. Can we get this sooner? This is great. Can we get this sooner? And I was like, I don't think that worked. Like, it's like trying to push all the water in a pool to one end. Like, it's just going to keep flowing back. And yet somehow I look at it now and I'm like, somehow I got it all sooner. Like, and it wasn't even just by cutting words. It was just this, I don't know there, you know, there was about 6 weeks there where I was like, this is impossible. This can't be done. I can't do it. And then suddenly things clicked and yeah. I just love it so much. And it made, for me, at least it made, my edits with my editor really simple.
The edit letter was so chill.
Yeah. Embarrassing. It was like a couple paragraphs. I was like, I want a little bit more here and a little clarity here. And I was like, what? That's it? Okay, cool. And then I think I had said, like, how many words? Like, do you have a word count in mind? And my editor, Chelsea, had really pushed me to get it as lean and tight as possible. And so we went on submission with it about 83 or 84,000 words. And then my editor was like, like, you go up to 100 or so. That's fine. And I was like, oh. It was like we had this condensed, streamlined, perfect version. And then finally, someone was like loosening the reins just a little bit and just letting me bulk it up a little in the ways I wanted to, but not actually change it. And it was nice. Well,
yeah, I think she's got it right. Whereas like, I think she wants to hand this, you know how, like when, if you're renting an apartment or buying a home, you go in and you want to see what of yourself you'd put into that home.
Yeah.
So they make the walls white. They make it as kind of blank as possible. You want to hand them something that they see their own vision for it, not a mess that metaphor. They feel like they have to clean up, you know?
Yeah. And I like to think of it too as like a stew. Like when you put all the ingredients in a stew at first, like it's kind of watery. Like each bite's not going to give you every flavor you want, but that's why you cook it for so long. You know, you boil it down, you reduce it and you concentrate it. And so I think by doing that, by really focusing on revisions, you know, and I'm a Pitch Wars mentor and I'm working on that with my mentee. And I did the same with my mentee last year, this focus on like, you're trying to kind of pare away all the excess to get so that all the great stuff is there. And then an editor can just give you that rein to say, okay, like I loved this so much, you know, I gobbled it up in one sitting. Now I want even more of this character or even more of this here, but you don't then have to like rewrite the book. They don't have to search through, you know, hundreds of thousands of words to find the goodness because it's just laid out on a plate for them, which it's hard work to get it there, but it's very cool when it does. Now, it'll be interesting because now I think both of us are starting or are in, I don't know exactly where you are in the process of writing a new book with our agents and editors. And how's that going for you?
Yes.
It's very different.
Hold on. I'm just going to pause to yell at them for a second.
Okay.
Hey, guys. Is it possible to be more quiet? Thank you.
The eternal struggle.
They're like getting pots out or something. So I actually wrote, I wrote book two. I thought I would never be able to do it. I feel like I wrote you a frantic email saying, how does this work? How does a person write a book two?
If you remember what I told you, please tell me, because I don't know how to write a book. It's killing me slowly.
I did an IG live recently where I quoted you because I think I also emailed you after the first draft. I'm like, this is disgusting. And you said, yes, first drafts are like mud demons.
Yes, they're terrible.
And I was like, yes, that's it. That's perfect.
Yeah. It's like you're, Anna and I like to talk about making the clay. You're just making the clay and then you'll shape it later. But it's so hard, especially when you've gone, you know, through revisions with someone like Chelsea, with an editor, and you're like, wow, like this book is exactly what I want it to be. It's so perfect. And then you start a new one. And it's like, what are words? How does this work? But for the first time, you have other people counting on you and other people who want to see the mud demon. And that's been hard for me as someone that, like, I don't like sharing work when it's really, really ugly. And I did just send a, we'll call it a half of a zero draft. And then like, an act that's just kind of like note card scenes thrown all over the page and then like blah, blah, blah at the end. And I sent that to Chelsea and I know she will be kind and supportive and wonderful. But like this part of me inside is like, oh, my gosh, I can never like face anyone again. The fact that this exists in the world is so mortifying, but it's the process. It's what it is.
It is. And it's just so wonderful to have somebody like Chelsea in your corner because she just, I don't know. She sees it like you can imagine. It's like sort of like I imagine it like the Queen's Gambit where she sees the chess pieces on the ceiling and she's like, no, if we do this and we put this clear.
Exactly what I need right now. I need someone to be like, okay. I see what you're hoping to do. Let's talk about this because I just reached the point where I was like, I don't know anymore. Like I actually have an outline, which I never do because Chelsea had me outline it. But it turns out for me, the outline, like knowing the plot beats is not the hard part because like I look at my outline and I'm like, okay, I have this one thing and that's supposed to be like 10 chapters, but what happens in the 10 chapters? Like I know the important plot moment, but there's still a lot of writing to be done and that's kind of where I run into it. So I learned for me, my process, I was trying to push through a whole draft all at once and I realized too late. I was trying too hard to kind of get water from a stone. And so I am now going back to sort of my original process, which is to share, you know, one act with a critique partner and just talk about it and brainstorm, because it's amazing to me how having someone else read it, you know, whether it's your agent, whether it's a critique partner, they just throw things out there and ideas, even sometimes predictions like, oh, like I keep wondering, like if this person's going to go there, and then it just gets my gears turning, whereas they have been so stuck for so long. So that has been like my big take home lesson of the book two situation is don't try to change your process. Like use your agent or your editor to facilitate your process, but don't think, okay, well now I'm under contract, so I have to do it some arbitrary other way, because I don't think that usually works for people, but I don't know.
Yeah, no, I think that's the great thing about having critique groups and critique partners and more than one, because sometimes they'll say something that's even like wrong or that you hate your book, but it gets you thinking. You feel so protective of whatever they said to change, and then you're like, oh, this is how I change it.
Yeah.
So even if they don't say the thing that fixes it, it is the thing that fixes it, because it, like you said, gets your gears turning.
Yeah, I found that with character development. Like sometimes people will say like, oh, it would be funny if this person did this, or if this like romantic love interest did this, and I'm like, no, they would never do that. And I realize, okay, I know who this character is to my bones, to the point where someone's offhand comment like almost hurts, because I'm like, no, that is not what this person would do, which makes me realize, okay, I need to clarify this character for the reader. And also kind of gives me the boost of confidence of being like, okay, no, I do know this character. I know what they would do. So that's not what they would do. Let's think of what they would do. And it is, I just think we make such a big deal about writing being a solitary process. And I don't think it is for most people. At least it certainly isn't once you're actually, you know, you have books coming out. So I always encourage people to like get out of your little privacy hut and let other people in, because it can only get better with more creative brains. Because like you said, even if they don't say the right thing or make the right suggestion, it's still going to help you clarify what you want to do, which is awesome. So yeah, when does your book come out? Remind us. March.
Oh, right? So yes, I keep on remembering. I have to just like say the title all the time now.
Yeah.
Drew LeClaire Gets a Clue comes out March 1st of 2022. Yeah. And that's less than 3 months away.
Time flies. Yeah, it is. I cannot believe it's almost 2022. I guess by the time this airs, it will be 2022. Wow. Yeah. So your debut experience so far, what has been unexpected? Anything?
I think I thought when I got an agent, I would chill out and I'd be like, it's finally done. But then I went on sub, and even though I did not have a terrible sub experience, like mm-hmm. so many have, I was still incredibly stressed out going into it. And then I thought, if I just get this book deal, I'll chill out.
Yeah. No.
And then I got the book deal and I have just not chilled out. I got the second book going on. And then like I wrote the second book. My editor liked the second book. I'm revising it the second time with her now. And it's still, I still am not chilled out. So I'm wondering, yeah, will I chill out when the book comes out? Probably not.
No, I think not unless you make a conscious effort to. Like, I do have some friends that it was like, you know, 2 days before their book came out and they were like, all right, I'm signing off. I'm just getting off the computer. I'm walking away and I'm going to go, you know, sit on a beach somewhere with my family. And I think unless you do that, I think it's hard to chill. You know, there's that moment every debut has where I think you realize for the first time, like you go from like, people are going to read my book to people are going to read my book. And I don't know about you, but I feel this intense sort of vulnerability, which is funny because when I share work with critique partners, like I don't necessarily feel it. Like it's I guess it's because when you share it with other writers or agents or editors, it can be stressful for different reasons, but it's like, we're all professionals here. Like we know what we're working on. Whereas handing it over to readers is this moment of like, okay, there's my heart and soul and thoughts on the page. And I'm just like throwing it out there for the world. And it's not coming back to me. It's just a weird, it's exciting, but it's, you know, it's a lot, I think.
Oh yeah. It's nerve-wracking, especially when I think about my opinions on some very well-received classics. And I think somebody's going to have this opinion and worse about.
Oh, yeah.
And there's nothing I can do about it.
No. Nope. One of my favorite things to do is to go on like Goodreads and find books that I love and then read their 1-star reviews.
Same.
Because it's a great reminder that like you cannot win everyone. And there are times where I've gotten, you know, critique or review that didn't like something or didn't like this. And I get that initial reaction of like, you know, defensiveness. And then I stop and I ask myself, if you had gotten this feedback before the book was finished, would you have changed what you wrote? And most of the time, I think, no, I wouldn't have. I wouldn't have changed it just because this person didn't like this thing, because I wasn't writing it for this person. I was writing it for myself and I was writing it for as many readers as possible. And there's no such thing as a perfect book that everybody likes, because we all like different things. Thank goodness. Otherwise, someone would write one perfect book and that would be the only book that anyone would ever read. So that has helped me keep it in perspective. But I'm also surprising myself with how good I am at not reading reviews, because I thought I was going to be all up in those. But it was like once it went up on NetGalley, I was like, nope. I don't want to know. So, do you read the reviews?
I mean, yeah. Of course, yeah. I do. Yeah. I'm going to need to cut myself off at some point, because with a middle grade, you're not getting quite the same pre-reads that YA is. Yeah. So like I'm just getting some booksellers and librarians, and they're usually pretty kind and even-handed.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas like you're getting all sorts of book bloggers and just random readers for YA,
yeah,
and they can be a lot more cruel.
Yeah, so that was a big shift, I think, because initially, like when my editor started sending out like physical bound manuscripts, you know, she was sending it to booksellers, to people that she has a relationship with because they tend to like her books. You know, people were saying, oh, I love all of your books. I would love to read this one. And again, like you said, you know, they're professionals who, even if they have critique, they're going to say it in a tactful way. But yeah, there is this moment, especially in YA, where our readership is on, they're on NetGalley. They're on, you know, they're doing the giveaways, they're taking stuff. And, you know, so far from what I've seen in my like minimal peeking, it's going well, but it's still, yeah, it's a wide audience. And also, I think it's got to be tricky for middle grade because your target readership isn't reading, like they're not leaving reviews. I mean, I don't know, maybe they are, but like my 11-year-old is not going on Goodreads to write about all the books she loves, which is kind of a bummer for those authors. Sorry to those authors because she loves the books. So yeah, you're only getting parents and librarians and such. And I would imagine that parents probably skew, like, I don't know. I feel like most parents who leave reviews on behalf of their children, it's probably more the parents that like have an issue with a book. Yeah, exactly.
Yep.
Because again, I'm thinking, well, I've never left reviews for the books that my kids love necessarily, but like, that doesn't mean they don't love them. Maybe they need like a little kid version of Goodreads where it's just like, kids can be like, I like it. It's funny.
Maybe. I think we rely, middle grade, we just rely a lot on the teachers and librarians to review it. The gatekeepers, I guess. Because, yeah, like, I mean, I don't know. I've heard it from other middle grade authors, but basically the advice I've gotten is do not compare yourself to YA. It's a completely different beast. 100%. There's so much under the iceberg that happens before release in YA. Mm-hmm. And middle grade is almost all, like, above the iceberg. Like, it's when it comes out and the year after.
I could see that.
So I have to keep reminding myself of that because I'm like, no one's reading it. No one's reading it.
Yeah. But at the same time, yeah, I mean, you get those librarians and those booksellers, and they're the ones that are going to be, you know, handing it to readers. And then, I mean, we all know kids, like, word of mouth is huge. When my kids read a middle grade book that they love, they talk about it all the time. They tell their friends about it. Their friends pick it up at the library. Like, then it spreads. But it's hard to generate buzz when your target readership is not on the internet. So that makes a lot of sense. But I hadn't really thought about the timeline, but yeah, that's so interesting. Do you have any plans for your launch week? Are you going to hide? Are you going to have a party?
I'd love to have a party, but COVID seems to have different plans.
Yeah, true. Maybe by March it'll be.
Maybe in March. It's possible. I'm planning on a virtual launch, but I will have an in-person launch. I'm boosted. Yeah. I'm ready to go.
The weather will be nice there, too. Like, you're in a warmer climate, so I feel like by March you can do outside stuff, too.
Oh, it's true. We can do outside stuff. Like, for whatever reason, the first week of March, it gets kind of hot in the Bay Area. I don't know why.
Interesting.
Like, it gets hot and then it gets cold again.
Like,
up and down kind of scenario until June.
Yeah, I'm in Virginia where people talk about seasons, but we don't really have seasons because, like, last week it was almost snowing and then it's like 70 degrees yesterday. We just go all over the place all winter. So it's a total crapshoot. But my book comes out in June, so it'll be hot. It'll be very hot.
It'll be hot. I'll be out in your area, actually, because I'm going to go to ALA.
Oh, when is ALA?
ALA is in D.C., and it's the third weekend of June.
Okay. Yeah, that's right when my book comes out. Yeah, maybe we'll cross paths.
Maybe.
Yeah, it does work with my the setting of my book, though. It will be on brand, since it does take place in, you know, a fictionalized Amalfi Coast island, which I guess isn't really a coast if it's an island, but it'll be hot and humid.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. What was your inspiration for writing about that area? Just because I'm Northern Italian.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So a bunch of reasons. One, I traveled there years ago and was just obsessed. I loved it. And I have, so my mother speaks Italian. One of my closest friends from college lives in Rome. And I think a part of it, honestly, was I had started writing the book, and I tend to, when I start writing, I often tend to not do a lot of world building, a lot of setting at first. Like, my first round, I'm really focused on the story, and then I sort of like layer in the setting. And I honestly think it was, I was, this friend who lives in Rome, has two daughters the same age as mine, and she comes to the United States every summer, and we usually spend a week at the beach, just the two of us and our four girls running around. And her youngest understands English, but mostly only speaks Italian. So So there's a lot, there's Italian everywhere. Like everyone's, you know, there are four little girls running around the house, screaming at the top of their lungs. You know, you have a, I think at that point they were like six and seven or something. And so my youngest and her youngest, like they're playing mermaids in the pool and like her daughter's only speaking Italian and my daughter's only speaking English. And yet somehow in the way of children do, they understand each other. And I think I was just at that point in the storytelling process where I was starting to build on the setting and I was just surrounded by all of this Italian all the time. You know, there are posters on the wall of their family beach house that has the Amalfi Coast. And I thought, you know, why not? Why not add in this place that always calls to me? Like whenever I think of traveling abroad, that's always where I want to go. I think it's just a magical place. And so it just sort of grew from there. And at this point, Italian is a really central part of the story, which wasn't necessarily my intention when I began, but it just kind of took off from there. And so, yeah. So thankfully, again, I do have, she is there because I'm not fluent in Italian. I know a little bit, but I'm not fluent, but I have my mom and I have her. So, and actually my editor took Italian in college. So it all kind of worked together. So I spend a lot of time messaging people being like, hold on a second. Is it D or Della? Is it like, what, yeah. Which, am I getting the grammar right here? But yeah. And you know, especially in the past few years when travel has been so limited and I can't go anywhere, it's been really awesome to be able to kind of step back into my happy place every time I work on revisions for this book. So, but yeah, but the sequel is going to take us off the island to other parts of Italy, which again, it fictionalized Italy, which is different because there aren't necessarily people living in it the way I've set up this world. But yeah, I always hope to go back before I finished writing the sequel, because I would love to, you know, call it research and wander around for a little bit, because I've been to Italy quite a few times, but it's been almost a decade since my last trip. So I don't, alas, think that's going to happen because I have to turn it in probably by June. Don't think I'm going to make it to Italy before then. But my parents are going back and they have promised to take one of my arcs and take pictures of it everywhere they go. So.
Oh, like the gnome.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, that was my Instagram content for the rest of the year. So yeah,
that was great. Yeah, I'm diving into your book actually just now, and it's giving me all the feels because I'm Italian, but I've never been to Italy. I've always wanted to go.
Oh, you have to. Do you have dual citizenship?
I have family there. I have family there around Lucca.
Ah, nice.
Is where my family originates, and I've always wanted to go. My grandfather, he was actually knighted by Italy because
he did
Italian-American relations. He worked in San Francisco with the Italian American Alumni Foundation at our college. And I have a lot of backgrounds actually, but I feel the most Italian.
Yeah. Did you ever try you can get the dual citizenship if you have, you can trace your lineage.
I call it. It's just COVID has shut down the embassies. So we have to get an apostille because it's crazy. You have to get like a private apostille here. But yeah, I think I should be able to do it.
Nice. It would be so tempting. There are so many times over the past year and a half where, you know, they'll have those articles. It's like this small town in Italy is trying to get people to move here. So the houses are like, you know, $5,000. And I thought,
it's true.
I could just move. When my kids were in virtual school, I was like, I don't know, maybe if I could just get over there, just stay put. If I have to hunker down, I'd rather hunker down there than here. Alas.
It is prettier than it is here, but yes. I would say there's a lot of parallel political issues in Italy.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure.
I read recently, actually, I reread recently, I read it a couple years ago, this book, The Monster of Florence, which really, if you ever want to read something very fascinating, is an illuminating take on the Italian justice system.
Oh, yeah, I can imagine, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a complicated place. It's funny because my world is a fictionalized religion and all this fictionalized stuff. And so it's been funny because I know some people have read it who are very familiar with Italy and sometimes I think draw more conclusions than there are about the religious structure and stuff. And I'm like, no. Like the setting and the language and the food are Italian. But like when it comes to like the political and religious structure of my world, it's just completely, I just made that up. So if you are in Italy reading it, it's not any real world religion or real world political system. I actually worked really hard to make it not, because I wanted to create a world where like the power structure is not based on anything hereditary. Like there is no you know, you there aren't a king and a queen. You don't marry someone and have to have children to pass down the lineage, because really the most, there's a good council, but then the most powerful people are the Font and the Fenestra, and they are, Fonts are just born with certain powers, and the Fenestra is chosen whether she or he or they like it or not. And so, yeah, there is no, there's no hereditary system, which is, it's tricky to create a sort of monarchy that's not a monarchy, because there is no sort of lineage there, but that was interesting.
Well, magic can do anything. When you add magic.
Magic can do anything. Yes, exactly.
Yeah, I'm actually really envious of fantasy writers, because I'm really not a fantasy writer. I have to ground everything in reality. And I'm like, oh, if I were a fantasy writer, I could just make this work.
Yeah. It has its pros and cons, because, yeah, there's, on the one hand, it's like, all right, well, I can, you know, I can create magical solutions or magical problems. But then there's also that, like, oh, no, I have to invent all this stuff. And there are always people that want more world building, and there are always people that want less of it. So trying to find that balance is quite tricky, because people will ask you questions like, well, what happened? What's on the other side of, you know, this planet? And there are times I just want to go, it doesn't matter. Don't worry about it. It's not relevant right now. Yeah. But I actually, This Vicious Grace was actually the first fantasy I completed. Before that, I wrote mostly young adult science fiction, which is a little different, because I wrote kind of near future science fiction. So kind of grounded in our world, but with, you know, stuff we don't have. And so switching to fantasy was a bit of a leap of faith. And I've had a lot of fun with it. But I also, you know, have mad respect for people that can write the big sprawling worlds, because I can't, like you said, I have to ground it in reality, even though it is fantasy, which I think is why I really kind of tried to set it in a place that I have such, like, visceral sensory memories of, because I can't just create something out of nothing. And yeah, for me, it was like, we talked about earlier, it was my screw up book. It was my, I'm writing this character dynamic that I want to write and I've wanted to explore forever. I'm writing it in the place that I wish I was right now. I'm writing it in, you know, a world where I wouldn't want to be in Alessa's shoes. But again, you know, I love the thought of a world where power has nothing to do with, you know, you're not born to the right family, that being wealthy or not wealthy doesn't make a difference, that who you marry and love doesn't matter. Because one tricky thing with fantasy is a little harder. Like, they don't have reproductive technology and stuff. But I wanted to have it set up so that, you know, there aren't a lot of the prejudices that we have in our world that I think in a lot of ways exist because so much of our history has been based on, you know, hereditary. People had to marry to have children, which meant that marriage was a political thing, not a thing out of love, because you had to have children to pass your power and your money onto. And I wanted to create a world that kind of separated that out for some people, at least.
Which was, I think we write our ideal worlds in a lot of ways. I remember reading an interview with Gene Roddenberry where he talked about that with Star Trek for him.
Yes.
And yes, I do just say watched. Star Trek. I'm one of those. I love it.
I was watching a Star Trek movie last night, actually. So.
I love
perfect
it.
Perfect transition. So do I. I'm a total Trekkie. Yeah. I was watching the 2009 with Chris Pine, which I'm a big fan of.
I love that one.
Yeah. There are so many, like, winks and nods to those of us that were fans all along, which I just think is great. I love books and TV shows and movies and media that, like, that is fun for an audience on its surface, but that also has this sort of kind of loving winks towards people that have been there. I just think that that's really fun for readers. So
how far into Trek have you gone? Have you watched all of the series or just mostly original?
I was the Next Generation girl, really. Okay. So I was raised on TNG. Wesley Crusher was my first crush ever. <Okay. laughs> I had a little transporter toy that you could spin it and you put the little figures in it, you spin it and they disappear because they get
loved it. That. Yep.
But then because of that, my parents also watched the original, and so we watched enough of that to put context for the movies, because they used to watch all the, you know, the original movies. I watched the Deep Space Nine, and then I watched some of the newer ones, but yeah, I haven't gone down all the evidence, but I used to read the books, all the TNG books, like I had all those on my shelf, so yeah, sort of specialized, localized knowledge, but enough of the surrounding stuff to provide context. So
sure. TNG is my absolute favorite. Picard is my favorite captain.
Yep.
I think it has best series finale of all time, to be honest.
It's wonderful. Now I want to rewatch. Like, I have time to do any of that. Yeah. Take a year. So have you read anything recently that you have enjoyed in your genre that you would recommend to people, or any genre for that matter?
Oh, yeah, actually, I mean, I'm trying to think because I've been writing so hard and I go through these binges where I'll write a book and then I'll furiously read like 5 books.
Yeah, I do.
And then I'll like go into a writing binge again. And I haven't re-entered my reading binge again, but recent, like a couple months ago, I read Stand Up Yumi Chung. And it was so good. Yeah.
Awesome.
It's this girl who wants to be a stand-up comedian, but her parents want her to become a doctor. And it's
that.
Just really sweet. And it's just about being exactly who you are and following your passion. And that really resonated with me because so much of my book kind of has to do with that. My main character has a really unconventional, you know, she doesn't want to be a, you know, a doctor or a ballerina when she grows up. She wants to be a criminal profiler.
Yeah, I love it.
And she has this hero, this female criminal profiler in the book named Lita Miyamoto, who I kind of based on, I don't know if you've read about this or seen it at all, but have you heard of I'll Be Gone in the Dark?
Yes, I watched it.
Yeah. So I kind of loosely based it on if Michelle McNamara was actually like an FBI criminal profiler.
Oh, cool.
And if she were still with us. And so my main character has this, you know, she wants to be that way. She wants to be a world-renowned criminal profiler who happens to be a girl.
That's very cool. Have you ever thought of combining your love for things like Star Trek with middle grade? Have you thought of branching out into middle grade speculative at all? Or you think you're going to keep it grounded in reality?
I think it's really hard for me. Like, I think if I wrote a fantasy or a speculative, I think it would tend to go more towards spooky, spooky paranormal.
Yeah.
Because I believe in ghosts. I believe in all that stuff.
Yeah, so it helps if I do. What's the show? I'm like blanking on it right now. The one with the brothers.
Oh, Supernatural?
Yes. I was just thinking like, oh, middle grade Supernatural could be cool.
Could be. Well, I haven't written this book yet, but I've recently become obsessed with these figures that people see in the mountains of Big Sur called Dark Watchers. Ooh. And people think they're showing up like from different times and different realities to like watch what's happening in our society, like aliens.
Whoa. That's wild.
That's the most sci-fi I've gotten in my
life. Nice. I agree that. Well, again, too, with like contemporary fantasy and contemporary sci-fi, like you still get to have the real world. You know, you're not creating an entire, you know, magical system or political system. You're just kind of adding your own take to it. So that could be cool.
Well, and it's funny how you talked about world building and how like some of the fantasy authors really go deep into that. But I guess as I'm reading your book, I realize like This Vicious Grace is one of the only types of fantasy I can read. Because I need fantasy that really focuses on the characters.
Yes. Yeah,
which
same.
Is why usually I just won't read fantasy or science fiction at all. But like, for example, The Lunar Chronicles, I could not stop reading it. There's so much snark. There's so much character development. Mm-hmm. And I also need books to be funny. And sometimes books get into the world building and they forget to be funny ever. And I really need a little bit of that.
Yeah, I want my, like when I read and when I write, I want it to be characters that I would want to be in the room with them. And I think, you know, I think it's different for everyone. I think some people really love, you know, they love angst or they love drama. And I love those too. But I always think if I've never seen these characters laugh, then I can't relate to them. That's why, like, I think, I don't know how far in you are, no spoilers, but so much of this book is like, Alessa has so much of me in her. And so to be, have this bodyguard that like, does not want to find her funny and does not want to smile, like that's a challenge she cannot resist because she's like, no. Like there's not going to be someone living in my rooms that is serious all the time. I can't take it. And so she does everything in her power to make him crack. And I think that really kind of sums me up pretty well. And so, yeah, I wanted it to be, you know, it started with the characters. All my books start with the characters. I often start with kind of a problem and then build the characters based on that problem. But then the rest of the world building exists to serve that purpose and not the other way around. So, you know, I knew when I wrote it that I wanted to have this girl who couldn't touch people, who desperately wanted human connection, and this boy who thinks he doesn't need human connection, who is somehow going to be playing a role in her thing. And then so from there, I was like, well, okay, she can't touch anyone. Why would this be a problem? Well, obviously, they're the obvious reasons, but like, what could make it a really, really big problem? Okay, well, what if she has to touch someone to save the world? okay, that mm-hmm. seems like it. And I just kind of expand from there and sort of create the world and the stakes and the everything around it. But it always comes yeah. down to the fact that at the end of the day, she needs to be able to touch someone to save the world, but she wants to be able to touch people because she's so isolated from other people because of this deadliness of her. So
yeah. Yeah, it reminds me of like Rogue from X-Men.
Yes, not an right? accident. Yes.
Yeah.
I think that nestled in my subconscious a very long time ago. And it's just always occurred to me. And it's so funny too, because with this book, I wrote it before COVID hit. We went on submission and sold in March of 2020. And all of a sudden I had this book and I kept thinking, people are going to think I wrote this book because I learned what it was like to be so isolated from other people during COVID. But I didn't. I wrote it before that. I've always been playing with this idea. But I hope now that it resonates with readers in a whole different way, because I think people now do understand like how incredibly important it is to, you know, to be around other people. Like we've yeah. learned that Zoom is great. Thank goodness for it. But not the same thing as sitting next to someone on the couch. And so yeah, I think her plight is very relatable. I think it hits a little harder, but hopefully not in a way that is like traumatic. Like I don't think so. I think at this point we're so far into it that we're all like, I feel you, girl. Like that does stink. You know, not to mention like she's not trying to date, but she is trying to find a partner. And that is especially hard to do when you can't physically get close to people. So
yeah.
Poor girl.
Yeah.
Mean. I'm sorry, Alyssa. Well, this has been fantastic talking to you at last. I'm so glad we finally pulled this off.
Yeah.
Figured out our technology, and hopefully Anna can take us the rest of the way there. So is there anything else that you would like to tell our listeners before we say our farewells?
I'm trying to think. I think just like I really, truly found my community with Murderinos.
Love it.
And yeah. I felt alone for a really long time. I've loved true crime since I was about 9, 10. And, you know, my dad and I would like hunker down with baguettes and olive oil and we'd watch a true crime documentary.
It's of heaven.
Yeah, everybody thought I was so creepy. And I was just so grateful to find this group of women who consumed it in the same way I do, like as a protective kind of way. Like, how mm-hmm. can I avoid this happening to
yes.
me studying it? And it really did embolden me seeing that play out in real life to write this story. So
I love that. Taking the power back. I've always thought, you know, I wrote a lot of dystopian and people would say, well, why would you want to write dystopian? Like the world is bad enough. And I realized that for me, it's the same thing. It's like, if I can write stories and read books where characters are faced with the worst thing possible, the story is almost always about them getting through it, getting past it. Like in post-apocalyptic stuff is like, we're still here. You know, the world, the plague happened or the meteor hit or whatever, but we're still here. We're still existing and we're still living. And I just think that is it's a strange sort of dark and twisty hope, but yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, you're watching the things, you're facing the things that scare you because it feels like you are arming yourself with the knowledge to protect yourself. And I think that so much of middle grade readers especially too, the whole world is kind of intimidating, you know, when you're yeah. 8, 9, 10, 11. And so being able to read books where characters are doing the things that you maybe would like to do, but you're intimidated by, or they are facing the things that you are afraid of facing. They're being honest about who they are, even when it's hard, is that same idea, is that you're getting a chance to kind of test out things in the safety of a book because you don't actually have to do it in real life. And I think that sets them up for success. So I'm so glad there are people out there like you writing that stuff because yeah, middle grade intimidates me. Everything intimidates me that's not like my specific genre. So
that's funny because only YA intimidates me and only fantasy intimidates me. I could do middle grade, I could do adult, but I cannot. I don't know.
Yeah, I heard something once on a podcast actually that said I think it was the First Draft pod where she said she has a theory that most people that write YA had some sort of like life altering event happen when they were in their teen years that almost like kind of like puts a pin in what it's like to feel that way so that they can go back to it so easily when they're writing. Like a lot of people moved in high school, like a lot of YA writers moved or had something like that happen that just like I think just kind of like changed the way their brains work. And so we are able to like hop back into that mindset, but I don't know.
It's a curse. It's a blessing and a curse.
Exactly. Well, this is great. So great talking to you. We will make sure that we have links in the show notes to all your stuff. And I know that I will be running into you in our 22 debut Slack and probably more panicked emails before our books come out.
Probably.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks again for stopping by, everybody. Remember to check out Drew LeClaire Gets a Clue. You can buy it anywhere books are sold. I have put a link in the show notes for everything about Katrin Burry and her book that has just come out. Please go support her. It's fantastic. It's wonderful. It speaks to everything that, you know, middle grade Anna definitely needed. We have lots in store for you this next season, so stick around. Remember, if you liked what you heard, go like, subscribe, go tell all your friends about it. I don't know. Tell everybody about this podcast. Thanks.